I've been trying all weekend long to find out who Mary Ann was, and we never run across each other. But this morning I was over in the chapel and she was over in the chapel, so I think God took care of that for us. So anyway, we didn't have a chance to talk, and I think we're really going to get to enjoy Mary Ann from New York City this morning.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mary Ann, and I'm a grateful member of the Tuesday night East Williston group on Long Island. That feels good. I said I was nervous, and I heard a girl say one time when she spoke that being nervous is just God shaking out the truth. So I hope he does shake out the truth in me, because that's the thing I think that helped me listen to the truth of other people's lives. Al-Anon is really a wonderful organization when you really think about it, because most of you really don't know me. People have worked very hard to make this convention this conference possible, doing all the behind-the-scenes works, and I get up here and take all the kind of glory to do the polishing and give the talk and aid my own recovery. And you kind of just trust that it will be okay, and I appreciate that. But I'd just like to tell you who you invited. About 7 years ago, I was on a retreat, not an Al-Anon retreat, a regular retreat. And I happened to room with a girl, and she needed Al-Anon desperately. She started to tell me a little bit about herself. And so you know how you start to tell people about your story and you try to introduce them to the program and everything. And so I was trying to do that to encourage her to come. And by the end of the weekend, she said to me, "Well, I would really love to go to Al-Anon," she said, "except I just don't want to turn out like you." Years before that would have devastated me. I would have thought, "Oh my God, I've carried the wrong message. What have I done? I've destroyed this person's life." But I realized that all you can do is say who you are. I've come from New York, and it seems like a faraway place, and I can't change my story. I can just say what happened to me. No matter where I go, I can't make it any better because it's a longer distance. I couldn't make it any better to fit her image either of what it should be. But the wonderful part is you don't have to ever turn out like anybody else. You just have to turn out like yourself. And sometimes the stories that other people tell, like the ones we've heard this weekend, give you the strength to find out who you really are and how you can change to be the person you want to be. Growing up, alcohol was not a problem in my home. But it's funny the kind of messages you get about alcoholism. They're subliminal. You know, I didn't even realize I was getting them. We had a woman on our block who came in and helped people because her husband was an alcoholic, and everybody knew it. And she used to do some ironing and cleaning for my mother. And her name was Anne, but nobody ever called her Anne. Everyone called her poor Anne, because that's the way she was. It didn't have anything to do with money. It had to do with attitude. And it was funny, she was a young person, but she had a tooth missing in the front. And so growing up, my entire impression of the person married to an alcoholic was somebody who had a tooth missing in the front. And it really stayed with me. My dad had a friend who was an AA, and the story that everybody kind of whispered was that he had worked for my father's company, he had been very successful, and he had to be fired because of his drinking. But he found this wonderful thing called AA, and he went to work for another company. He became the president of that company. My impression was you go into AA and you become financially successful. Those were my two impressions of a wife of an alcoholic and what AA was, because I had no other input. I had no other idea of what these, nobody ever told me. Drinking in high school was not a big thing for any of us in those days. But once I went to college, it was. And I met my husband the very first day of my college days. We were freshmen together. And I thought he was nice, so scholarly, a little quiet, and I really wanted to go out with somebody who was older, a fraternity man, somebody who was always looking for the group that had the most fun. So naturally, I always went out with the group that drank the most. But besides my husband, there was only one other person that I was ever really seriously attracted to. And the reason that I stopped dating him was because he drank too much. So I say to myself, when I looked at myself in the program after a while, what was it in me, the child calling to child, it says in the One Day at a Time book. I don't blame everything on him, my husband. There is something about me. Alcoholics are more fun, what can I tell you? And I found them very attractive. But the reason I stopped going wasn't my own self-esteem. My parents said to me, we know he drinks a lot, and if you don't think enough of yourself, we do. We think enough of you, and we forbid you to go out with him. And I was almost 19 at the time, and I hated them for it. I never dated him again. I knew they were right, but I was afraid already. I was afraid of alcohol because I knew it had some kind of control over people, and I couldn't control it. My husband was very different than this fella. This fella was very outgoing, fraternity type. My husband was scholarly and more quiet. The valedictorian of our class. It was very important to me that I marry somebody who was smarter than me. I had this idea that if you marry somebody good-looking and smart, you'll have good-looking, smart children and you won't have any problems. I had the feeling many times when I had heard one time that he got drunk at a college function, and I didn't go to this. And my thought was, if I had been there, he wouldn't have done that. Now, where my ego was, that I thought I had this kind of control over a man I wasn't married to, I wasn't engaged to, I was only a good friend of his. But that's the kind of feeling I thought I had over him. So that after we were married, when the drinking started, I was devastated. I was scared of it right away. I thought from the very, very beginning it was my fault. I asked him why he drank, and he said it was my fault, and so I believed him. We were married after college, and it was like the lieutenant and the school teacher going off into the sunset. We came and we lived in North Carolina for 2 years. I knew nothing about a geographic cure then. I knew nothing of those kinds of words or ideas. But we lived on the Marine base, and I thought it had something to do with military life. I wasn't sure in the beginning it was drinking. I thought it was that we just couldn't talk to each other. There was something wrong with our communication. Because any time we started a serious conversation, I would cry. I just couldn't seem to get it out. But this one particular time I remember, as most young couples, we had a budget. And I said to him, don't you think that there's something wrong with a young couple? We don't entertain very much. We always have money in the budget for liquor. And on the military, it's really quite cheap. And he explained to me that, you know how bad Coke and soda is for your teeth? So that eventually you wind up paying in the dentist for all this work that you'll have to do. So really, basically, it was cheaper to drink gin and tonics than it was to drink soda, and so the money stayed in the budget. And since he was smarter than I was, and the valedictorian, I never won an argument. I never won an argument. The denial became as great in me as it did in him. I didn't want to look at this. It was really very painful. But I did keep saying, well, when we go back to New York, when we transferred home, that was home, everything will be all right. And our first assignment, he decided to take a job without telling me, and we were going to Minneapolis. Well, I couldn't even spell Minneapolis. I was, oh my God, how could I go to Minneapolis? And I was having our first child. Anyway, the job changed and we went to Philadelphia, which was really, I felt like my backyard. But our first child was born. She had seizures from 24 hours old. And so this took, to a degree, it took some of the focus off the drinking. But growing up, my mom and dad had always said that when there's sickness in the house, it draws people together. But you can tell that they weren't living with alcoholism. Because this added sickness put an added wedge in between the marriage. And at this point, I became very, I would say, morbid. Because all I wanted to do was zero in on the problems. And all he wanted to do was run away from the problem. So I felt that he was being totally irresponsible, not wanting to discuss this. But the discussion never got anywhere. It was just to sit and discuss. It was never anything positive. I still, at that time, didn't blame the drinking. I was afraid of it. And I tried not to face it. And I remember one night, my mother had had a breakdown, and we had brought this baby home, and we were living with her while we settled into our own place. And he said to me, "Oh, I'll go up to the store to get something." And the minute he volunteered, I knew he was going for a drink. The word alcoholic came, and I had to push it down so fast because it was like too horrible to think about. I knew that lying was part of the disease of alcoholism. The funny part is lots of people say they didn't know it was a disease. I knew it was a disease. I knew lying was part of the disease, and none of that helped me because it gave me no direction. I thought it was my goal in life, my job to catch him in a lie. And if you've ever tried to do that, you know how wearing it is. And when I did at one point, after I was in Al-Anon and the people kept saying, "You'll find out, if you're to know, you'll find out." And I did. And you know what he said to me? He said, "Take all your consolation in being right." And you know, there's very little consolation in being right when you love somebody and you want to build a relationship on trust. Just being right is really not enough, and it's really very weak. I tried very hard to hide this from everybody. Not because I was trying to hide him as much as I was also trying to hide myself. Because I felt if I told my mother or I told any of my friends, they would say to me, "Well, if he really loved you, he would stop drinking." So I really didn't tell any of them till it became unbearable. And by this time, we had three children, and the oldest was 2.5. And I remember smiling all the time. I was always smiling, but I never really laughed. I don't know if you've ever been in this spot. There really is a difference. There really is a difference. This one day, I was kneeling on my living room floor, and I really said to God, "I just don't know what to do. I can't keep up the front anymore. If one more person asks me to do them one more favor, and I have to answer the door and smile one more time," I really thought I would go crazy. My brother came to the back door, and my brother was a seminarian at the time. He was studying for the priesthood. I shocked him. I opened the door. I said, "John, I think Ed is an alcoholic." It was the first time I got the word out. And he came in, and he listened to me. He stayed for about 5 hours. Well, when you have a couple of years stored up, and it all comes out... It just kept coming and coming. And I thought he would put his arm around me and tell me how wonderful I was doing. And he said, "You know, I really don't know that much about this problem." But he said, "I'm going back to school tomorrow, and there's somebody writing a book at the seminary on problems. I'm going to go and talk to him, and I'll call you up." Now, my brother's younger than I am, 2.5 years. So the next day, now... If you've lived in an alcoholic marriage, you always know the next day you feel a little different and things have a tendency to go off to the side. And my brother called me up and he said, "I've talked to this man," and he said, "The thing that you have to do is go to Al-Anon. Well, I hung up. I just said, "Not going. How I should go? I should go. He's the one that's doing this. Everything changed from the day before, and I just thought, well, he's younger than I am. What does he know? What does this guy who's writing a book know? I'm the one that lives here. So I hung up, and I said, I'm not going to Al-Anon. I'm not going anywhere. That was around May. Things got kind of bad, as they usually do, and I found myself in the basement. I had a phone in the basement, and I had these three little kids. And it was an August day, it was beautiful, and I was on the phone trying to catch him in a lie. He always wrote out checks, and he drank out of the house, so we had very high bar bills. And for some reason he thought, I think it was acceptable if he took all these priests out, that I would think it was acceptable, these bar bills. So I was calling all these priests to find out if he really took them to lunch, but I didn't want to tell them that I was checking up on him. When it really hit me, I should be outside with these little kids instead of in the basement. Now, I had a phone in the kitchen, but I went to the basement in case anybody would walk in and they would hear what I was trying to do. I really was hiding. So I said, maybe I'll just call that, we called it Intergroup at the time in New York. And I think this was a real turning point in my life. I called the woman and she answered the phone and of course, at this point, I was crying, which I always did. And she said, I don't want to go to the meetings. I just want you to tell me what to do so he'll stop drinking. And she said a lot of things. She said a lot of wonderful things. The only one that I remembered, though, was if you go to the meeting, you will never have to ask anybody again what the right thing to do is. You're going to know from the inside. And you know, that thought really stuck with me. I wanted so much to do the right thing. I really did, and I never was quite sure. I was always changing my attitude. I was always trying this and trying that. So I hung up, and I decided, I'm not going to go. Mm-hmm. And things, of course, got worse. And one day, I was able to get all three of them to bed at the same time. And I said, maybe it was on a Tuesday night, and that's when they said the meeting was. So I said, maybe I'll try it. And I went over. And I remember thinking it was in a Protestant church, and I'm a Catholic. And the only reason I went was because it was a Protestant church, because I figured every Catholic in the world would see me. And I just wouldn't dare go. I was so terrified. Never told him where I went. Never told anybody where I went. I told him I was going to a friend's house. I just couldn't say to him, I think you're an alcoholic. I thought the word was so harsh and so terrible, I couldn't get it out. When I went to the meeting, there was a group. It was a large basement church, and there was a large table, and people were sitting around it. And I went up and I said, is this Al-Anon? And they said, no, we're meeting for the Boy Scouts. The Al-Anon group is in the kitchen. And I could just feel, oh, everybody. See, at that time, my ego was everyone was staring at me. Everybody knew. Everybody thought less of me. And at the meeting, we sat around the table, and I sat down next to this woman, and she handed me a pamphlet. And she said to me, this is for you, dear, for the rest of your life. And I got up and I changed my seat. I thought, I'm not. This one is nuts. I'm not even coming back. The rest of my life, it was like, I don't even want to be here tonight. How could she even think? I heard a woman say, as they went around the table, you'll have friends. And I thought, oh my God, that's just what I don't need. I had all these friends that were asking me to do things. I don't know if you know the kind of friends I mean, that lean on you. And I'm the kind of friendly helper. I seem to want people to lean on me. Then when they lean on me, I don't want them to lean on me. But I remember that woman saying that. And I just raised my hand and I asked one question, because they said, does the newcomer have a question? And I said, can you ever have a normal life? And somebody shouted, just come back next week. I never really made a commitment to myself to come back next week, but if someone called me for about 3 minutes on Thursday, the meeting was on Tuesday, she called me and she said, did you enjoy the meeting? And I said, you're supposed to enjoy it? I had no idea of enjoy. I read everything, though. I took all the pamphlets home. She said to me, I think you need some of the books. She stopped by my house. She dropped off The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, One Day at a Time, was not in existence then. It wasn't written. and living with an alcoholic. The dilemma of the alcoholic marriage, I took the cover and I turned it inside out because I said, "I, what if anybody ever saw this? I just couldn't, I didn't even want to look at it, yet I wanted to read what was inside." They said, "Change, change, change." I didn't know what to change. A lot of the people there were, expressed themselves by screaming. Well, I have to tell you, I'm so mousy. I was afraid to scream. It was just not my style to scream. I'm a controller, but I do it with a velvet glove, which sometimes is worse. It really is. For me, I should say. But anyway, they said change. And I didn't tell them I went to Al-Anon. I was too afraid. There was no violence. It was what I thought alcoholic was that I was too afraid to say it. We had a ritual on Saturday morning since he drank at night out of the house. And the ritual went like this. I would have the coffee waiting. I would try to keep these three little babies quiet. And I would wait for him to wake up. And I would want to know why he drank. Because you see, I had been a science teacher. And if you have the cause and the effect, you take away the cause and you take away the effect. So if I knew why, I could take away the drunkenness, which was the effect of why. So in all our discussions, the cause, after we had about a two-hour discussion, it came down to, well, I drink because of you. And I wound up on a Saturday morning saying, "I'm sorry." And I said, "There's something wrong with this. I'm the one that's here. I'm the one that's trying to keep it all together." But I always wound up saying I was sorry. So when they said change, I said, you know, maybe I could change that. Maybe I won't have the coffee ready, and maybe we won't have that discussion. So that particular morning, we lived in an apartment where we had the basement rec room, too. And I went downstairs, and the kids went downstairs with me, and they had the cartoons on. And I was really trying to act as if. And I was folding the wash, and the coffee wasn't ready. And my husband came down the stairs, and he sat down, and he said to me, "I don't know what happened to you. You don't care if I drink." And I, at that moment, I bought the whole thing. Now, it's sad that I had to buy it because of him, but I knew that the people at the meeting knew him, in a sense, better than I did, because I did care desperately if he drank. But I knew I had to change something. And I had taken some pamphlets, and I was trying to be very cool. And I said, "Well, there are some AA pamphlets upstairs in my drawer," and I went to Al-Anon. Well, I think he was so shocked that the mouse did anything without asking that he called AA that day. But he didn't stop drinking. It took him a while. He found his way into the program maybe 8 months later. But I kept going to the meetings. I found myself from hating to go and not wanting to be there to racing on a Friday night. I had my foot on the gas. I couldn't get there fast enough. I couldn't soak up all that they had to say. I got a woman to be my sponsor, and I can't say enough for this, because to try different people all the time, it's very, very hard to explain where you are, and you have to do so much talking that if you have a sponsor that knows who you are and where you're coming from, it's just so much easier for you. And she used to say at the meeting, and sometimes I got mad at her because she kind of said the same thing. She would say, "A quiet time during the day is so important." Well, I never had a quiet time. I constantly was in motion. I either had to have the radio on or I had to be on the telephone. I was really afraid to be with my own thoughts. And she said, "If you only take a few minutes each day to have a quiet time." And I tried very hard to concentrate on Just for Today, the pamphlet. And if you know it, notice in there, there's something that says, "Do something nice for somebody and never be found out." Well, September 5th, I'll be in Al-Anon 20 years. I've never been able to do it. I always slip. Somebody always finds out. There's a lot here, so that the years that you're in doesn't really mean anything. People that are in much shorter than I, grab onto ideas that it's taken me so long to not to grab onto the idea, but to make it my own. It's different than intellectually getting an idea and putting it into your heart and acting out that idea. That's, to me, where it's very hard. The one idea that I found so very, very hard to grab onto, and I rejected it, was detachment. I thought detachment was the cardinal sin of being married. I did not get married to detach. I thought it meant cruel abandonment, emotionally leaving somebody. I got married to attach, and I was going to try. And if I didn't accept the second step, I had trouble with the second step too, because my mom had emotional problems. I could not stand it when people said at the meetings, "You're sick," or "We're sick," because I just thought, I can't be like her. I don't want to be like her. Nobody's going to tell me I'm like her. And so I thought the word insanity was wonderful for the AA people, but it was a little too strong for Al-Anon people. They could have come up with a better word. And it wasn't until I read, and at that time I tried to read everything I could get my hands on. And since there wasn't a lot of Al-Anon literature, I read a lot of AA literature. And there was a line that somebody wrote about the insanity of the second step, and it said, "Sanity is having a clear and uncluttered mind." And just reading, I can still see where that line was on the page. And I knew I didn't have a clear and uncluttered mind. I went shopping. I had three babies. I went shopping every single day to the supermarket. And I used to use the rationalization. Well, you have three kids. One has to sit in the basket, the little front thing, and the other two sit there, and there's no room for the groceries, so you can only buy a little bit. But that wasn't really why. The reason why was I couldn't clear my mind to make out a shopping list. My mind was so cluttered about what he was doing, what he could do, how would I change. And so it gave me a lot of peace to finally accept that. And when I could accept that insanity of the second step, I was able to accept the idea that I needed detachment. And this is how I work detachment. I never try to say I have to detach from him. I really don't think detachment has anything to do with separating, not being in the same room with somebody. You can be in another state, and somebody can live rent-free in your mind, and you brought them with you, and you're not detached. You can be in the same room and still have the emotional detachment that we talk about in Al-Anon. But it took me a long time to separate those two things. When I'm in a situation, and I've done this over the years, it's not just my husband. When I love anybody, I become too emotionally involved and invested in their life. And it usually causes me a lot of pain, and it causes them a lot of trouble because I'm interfering. So when it's time to detach, I usually don't say detach from them. I usually say I must detach from my old behavior. What's my old way of handling this? And I usually have to try some other new way. After my husband was in AA quite a while, he decided to change jobs, and he did, and then he lost his job. So we went through an unemployment for a while, and I remember saying, I have to work detachment. And I can still remember, during this 5 months, I remember buying myself a white pair of slacks and a blue and white checkered blouse. And that was my detachment, because my old way was to be never to buy myself anything, to watch him go play golf at least once a week while he was on unemployment, but I shouldn't buy anything. And the resentments would start to build. So for detachment for me is to change my old behavior. The other radical, radical idea in Al-Anon was one day at a time. I just never thought of that. There's something from my childhood, I think, that says, if I could project what's going to happen, I could prepare myself for what's going to happen. And then if I can think of the worst thing, I could be ready. Well, if you know the energy it takes to prepare yourself for all the negatives that can happen, there's no room left for God to put the good things in your life, because the projection becomes a snowball, and it just takes you so far down the path of fear and negative. I never project good things. It was always the negative that was projected. And so to try to live one day at a time was a very radical idea for me. And I'm very, very grateful for it. And it's something I still have to work on. Coming here this weekend was a wonderful thing for me. I really feel very renewed of spirit here. I got my feet back where my head was. And I'm back to being in the day we're in. And I'm not 3 weeks away from, which I was on Friday when I arrived. I was into September and what I have to do and worried. You know, worry is an exaggerated sense of what you're responsible for. I must tell you, I find myself, the minute something happens, I would not run for a drink because that's just not something that solves my problems. But I have to worry, and I have to try to put myself in God's hands constantly and give that up. Sometimes I'm able to do it, sometimes I'm not. My husband went to AA for a while, and so did I. He was in about 9 years, and I was in Al-Anon 10. And this is sort of a hard part to talk about, because it's kind of like people tend to want to believe that AA and Al-Anon puts marriages back together. But that's not really what AA and Al-Anon does. It puts people back together, and then you put the marriage back together. And we were drifting further and further apart. Now, I asked my husband to do a lot of things. I asked him to go a lot of places. I asked him to share the program. I asked him to go for counseling. I asked him to do a lot of things. And he refused. And when I asked him to move, he did. So it sounds as if I wanted the separation. I initiated the separation. And yet, actions speak louder than words. I don't blame him totally for the separation. I think love is kind of like it's almost like a plant, a living thing. You can't just let it go and not care for it, because somehow it dies. And our marriage, on one hand, on his side, seemed to die of neglect, and on my side, it seemed to die of over-caring. Overwatering. I was totally obsessed with the relationship, and I was constantly trying to make it better. You know, in the beginning of the welcome, it says, trying to force solutions make us irritable and unreasonable. And that's what I was trying to do. I wanted, with all my heart, I wanted the AA Al-Anon marriage to be together. And it just wasn't for us. It just wasn't to be. And so 10 years ago, we separated. And I'm telling you, the program made it easier. There's no nice way to get a separation, because it's a difficult thing. It's hard. But with the program, at least you have some boundaries, some guidelines. My group was very supportive. I was in a group for a very long time with the only one that had a sober husband. And I was afraid for a long time to even say that there were any difficulties. And once you become a guru or something of a group, forget it. Your recovery is at a standstill. If you're not honest and God's not shaking out the truth, I don't know what value the meetings have. So I gave that up. And when I went to the meeting and I started to explain what was happening and that this was going to happen. Nobody really seemed upset. It was, if you have to do that, then that's what you have to do. Oh, I forgot to mention, we also had another child, and she was a year and a half, and that's the little girl I brought with me. Now I was in waters I had never been in before. I was separated. I had four children. The oldest was 11, and the youngest was a year and a half. I thought that the sixth step, I think for me, is the hardest step, became entirely ready to have God remove all our character defects. Looking back, trying to force that marriage, I wanted so much to force a dream. And once we separated, and my husband visited, he visited every weekend, and we would have a conversation. And I would have to tell you that the physical feelings for him were the last to die. When he came to visit, I would look at him, and he's very nice looking, and I would say, what could have been, what should have been, what might have been, and we would get in the conversation, and I would say, what is, and that's why we're where we are, and that's why we have to be where we are. And it is the hurt and the disappointment has gotten less and less over the years. I mean, I have to tell you, there's always a place in my heart for him because he was very much a part of my life. And I do wish him well. And I see him every other weekend when he comes to pick up the children. And somebody asked me, well, are you friends? Well, we're not friends because a friend is somebody that you call when you need them and when you're in trouble. We're friendly. And that's what AA and Al-Anon has done for us. We're friendly. And we can talk about certain things about the children, but not friends. My friends are the people in Al-Anon, the ones that I say what's going on inside of me. During this time, I go back to the sixth step, trying to force that dream was a relief when I stopped. I was trying to explain to somebody, when I went to work, I hadn't worked after my children were born. So now I had these four children and I was working in the city and life was easier than when I was married and staying home. Now, unless you've been in that kind of a situation, always swimming upstream, I was much more lonely when I was married than when I was separated. I remember speaking somewhere, and I wasn't going to tell this, I don't know, and this man came up to me and he said to me, well, you must be frigid, that's your problem. And I know that everybody has to almost find a reason. Well, how could it be that two people are in AA and Al-Anon and it doesn't work? I can't explain it. I can just tell you that if you're in it, you'll understand. If you're not, well, you just have to accept that that's the way it was. I read in a spiritual book at that time when I separated that our security lies in our ability to change. And I really thought about that. I had always looked for security. I had looked for it in a man that was smart, that would make a good living, in my own education. I looked for it in health. I looked for it in family. And none of it gave me the security I need. It really is in the ability to change. And coming to Al-Anon makes it easier to change. And that's a good feeling. It does give me a sense of security. I think we kind of, when you talk about the past, it's a little bit easier. I don't know if you've ever spoken and you have that feeling that you're sort of stepping aside and talking about somebody else. And when you get a little closer to the present and the things that are close to your heart now, it's a little bit harder to talk about it. And God was very good. I had three children in college. They grew after I went to work, and this little one was 10 years old. And my son had a serious nervous breakdown. And you know, the program works, even when you apply it to things that are not alcoholic. Every one of the things that I learned in the meetings and stored up over the years, I had to pull out to get through this experience with him. He had one, and then a year and a half later, he had another one, and this one was much more serious. And we didn't know, he was hospitalized for 5 months. And we didn't know where he would live when he came out. And that was the 5 months that was so very hard for me. because we had to kind of coordinate the county, the state, the federal government, all the different aid programs. How would it ever dovetail in that it would all mesh in at the same time? There was room for him in the community residence, and would he have the attitude that he wanted to go to this community residence? And I worried, but not as I did years ago. I had people to talk to. I have to tell you, I did cry a lot. I did cry a lot, but that's okay. Somebody told me it was God shampooing your soul. And he got into the community residence a year and a half ago. And he's doing really well. He's got a job, and he's on a list for an apartment program, and he's doing quite well. And I am very grateful. But I have to tell you, the thing that got me through that experience was gratitude. Most of you know, I work at the WSO in New York. It's on Broadway. And if you've ever visited the city, there are some characters that walk the streets. And I would walk to work, and I would look at all the young men, and I would look in their eyes, and I would say, God, that guy is weird looking. Yet, you know, he's not hospitalized. He hasn't broken down. Why my son? How could he cope with his life? What is it that he has? And somebody said to me, you know, you're zeroing in on the wrong thing. You really should zero in on the gratitude. And she said, why don't you, when you drive home from the hospital, say a litany of gratitude. Thank God for the car, the heat, the doctors, whatever you can think of. And it was about a 25-minute ride, and that's what I did. And I used to talk out loud. And you know, after a while, I stopped looking at all the young men on the street. And I really focused in on going to work and being grateful for the job I had and the friends I had and the people that I could talk to. If I only had my neighbors, I don't know how people get through with neighbors and family and not Al-Anon people. I just don't know how they get through things. I really don't. I had to write these things down. It's not that I'm not speaking from my heart. It's just that sometimes the ideas don't come as fast as I would like them to. My attitude has always been one of the martyr. When I read the Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, and they had in there, and I think they've taken it out now, there are four kinds of people that marry alcoholics: the punisher, the martyr, the waverer, and the controller. Well, I suppose I could overlap and fit a lot of them, but martyr comes up high on the list. And recently, my brother was studying in Rome, and he had said, wouldn't it be nice if you could come over for the last week and visit me? And my sister and her husband too. And he had it all planned. Someone had lent him an apartment, and he was going to pay for the ticket. My very first thing was, absolutely, I can't go. How could I go? I'll stay home. I'll mind all the children. Right away, the martyr. And I said, you know, I really thought about it, and I said, you know, this is really, I have to really change these things. I'm really supposed to enjoy life. That's what I'm supposed to do. On the parts you can enjoy, you're supposed to enjoy it. So I went, and I went to Rome, and I went this May. And I went with my brother, and my sister and her husband joined us, and we had a wonderful time. You know the expression, we had the time of our lives. And I wrote my brother a thank you note. Somebody asked me, would you like to go back to Rome? And I said, no, because my whole life, I've tried to always recreate things. I was always looking to recreate the early days of our marriage, which couldn't be done. I was always looking to recreate the good times. So when I wrote him the thank you note, I said, someone asked me if I'd like to go back, and I said no, because that really belongs to you and Teresa. I'll have to go other places and have other new wonderful experiences. And the day I mailed that letter, I got a call that I won a trip to Paris in a drawing. So God does have wonderful surprises in store for us. I never would have thought that. I am trying to be open to those things. I am trying not to focus in on the negative and let God's grace come in to fill me. He only comes where there's a vacancy. And if there's no vacancy, he won't come. It's very hard for me to have that clear and uncluttered mind to allow him to come in. I can invite him, but it's almost like setting the stage when someone comes into your house and getting ready. And you know, it really goes back to that quiet time that my sponsor used to say very undramatically, take a quiet time every day. Most of you know that I work at WSO, and some of you have asked me, what do I do there? I'm the international secretary, and if you've ever been up there, I don't know if any of you have ever visited, but if you are in New York, you have an open invitation to visit the WSO. We give tours, and you go and you, it is your office. It isn't my office, it's our office. And on the wall in my room is a map, and there are flags. And there are 24 of them. And these represent the offices all over the world, Australia, where they do the kind of work that we do at WSO, where the people print literature, where they help new groups start. And people are always interested in the newest place. And I would say the newest growing place is Poland. There are 44 Al-Anon groups now in Poland. And that's a very amazing thing. And we had a psychiatrist from Poland visit, and she wasn't a member. But she said, the Polish groups now are deciding whether to come out publicly with the government and ask for government approval, or should they stay underground and meet without government approval. And she said, I'm really glad I don't have to make that decision. So maybe I could ask all of you to pray that they will make the right decision, because it is a big decision to help other people. You have to be part of that group conscience to know what's the right decision for that country. It's not easy trying to print literature when you're not allowed to, trying to meet in places where you're not allowed to assemble. In India, women have, and Al-Anon usually starts with women, I don't mean to exclude the men, but it usually starts with women have no right to assemble. They cannot meet in groups. In Costa Rica, it takes a whole year to save up to buy the book one day at a time. A whole year. And so we are very lucky in places where we live, even if you have to go 40 miles to a group. And I'd just like to close by telling you a story, which I think is significant. It was a professor, and he was preparing a lecture. And he had his little 9-year-old was bothering him, and he had a copy of the New York Times on his desk. And there was a map of the world. So he cut it up, and he gave her all the little scraps, and he told her to go in the other room and put it together, and when she had put it together, to come back. And she did. And she came back in a very short time. And he said to her, how did you do that? How did you put it back together? And she said, well, it was easy. There was a man's face on the back, and when I put the man together, the world came together. And that's really, I think, what we're trying to do in the program. Each of us, me on Long Island and you in all the different states that you're from, we're trying to put ourselves back together. And I guess there's really only one secret. And I guess the secret is you got to keep coming back. Thanks.
Marianne, West Virginia would like to really thank you for coming down this weekend, and here's a token of our appreciation. Yeah.
Thank you.
You want me to help you?
Yes.
Well, everyone stand now, and let's close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer, please.
Our Father, who art in heaven.